KTOO. Welcome to a Juno Afternoon. It's Wednesday, July 12th, 2023. I'm your host, Boston Christopher Gunathchish Hawa, for joining the conversation. On today's show, is a selective sports fishery for king salmon possible or desired here in Southeast Alaska? The Juno Library is hosting a group of researchers from the University of Washington who will have a presentation and Q&A discussing this possibility. And the Southeast Alaska Master Gardeners are well known here in Juno and are also very busy. We'll catch up with them and get a preview of the garden tour happening this Saturday. Those conversations, savory moment, bird note, music, and more coming up right here on a Juno Afternoon.
Hansen Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we ka shuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin tau ka na khaya ha ani kak gunil chish.
You're listening to Community Supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher, your host. So we're talking selective fisheries today. Is it wanted, desired, needed, all that good stuff? What is it? What is a selected fishery? That's a good question. Well, the Juno Public Library is hosting a presentation with a group of researchers from the University of Washington and folks from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, along with a discussion and Q&A to share their discoveries and workings of selective fisheries on the West Coast, highlighting both the benefits and the challenges. This event takes place next Monday, July 17th at 5 p.m. at the Mendenhall Public Library. Joining us to chat about it are Anne Beaudreau, Associate Professor at the University of Washington School of Marine and Environmental Affairs. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Boston. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And of course, we also have Margaret Lutke here from the Juno Public Library, our old friend. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Of course. It's great to have you both here. So, Anne, let's start with you. You're a former resident of Juno, and you were on the faculty. It's very strange. You were on the faculty of University of Alaska Fairbanks, but you were stationed here in Juno doing some research at Lena Point. Fill us in on your background and what you were doing here in Juno and in Fairbanks and how you got down to Washington and all that good stuff.
Sure. So, I was in Juno from 2012 to 2020 and on the faculty of University of Alaska Fairbanks. Some people don't know that the fisheries program there is based in Juno and Fairbanks. There's some folks in Seward and Anchorage, and so we're kind of spread out. And so I was always based in Juneau working out at Lena Point. So our building is right next to the NOAA lab out there. And then at the end of 2020, my family and I moved down to Seattle, where I started a position at University of Washington. And the department I'm in is very interdisciplinary, and we focus a lot on marine policy and the human dimensions of fisheries.
I see. Okay. And how did you get interested in marine biology? Was it when you were a kid?
Yes. The classic story of I actually grew up in the Northeast, and every time I went to the beach, I would just walk with my head down looking at the creatures and exploring the intertidal, and that really sparked my interest. But actually, I got into fisheries after college when I worked for a federal fishery management agency, the New England Fishery Management Council. And that's where I saw that intersection between people and fish and politics and how all of that plays out and making sure that people have fish to catch.
Right, right. Absolutely. And how did you decide? I'm just curious about this, but how did you decide to find a job in Fairbanks? Where were you when you found that job?
Well, I was never based in Fairbanks, actually. So I was in Seattle at the time when I had finished my PhD in fisheries and was looking for jobs. And the position in Juneau came up. And I had spent a little bit of time in Southeast Alaska before that and knew it was a place that I would absolutely love to call home. So
gotcha.
I was really lucky to get that position.
Was it always confusing for folks because they're like, you say you work at Fairbanks, but you live in Juno? And,
yes.
You know, and when the position was, when you found the position, it said it was listed to be in Juno. It
that's
was
right.
always to be here. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay. That's so amazing. That's a great thing, though. I mean, that's part of the University of Alaska system, I guess, is that
exactly.
we have all these great programs that are statewide. So Now, that work that you did here in Juneau, did that or does that impact the work that you are doing now on the selective fisheries research? Are you taking any of the things you learned here into that work?
Definitely. Yeah. So actually, I think for me, the origin story of working on salmon management issues actually started with rockfish fisheries. Some students and I were working on understanding how rockfish fisheries in the Gulf of Alaska have changed over the last several decades. And also understanding how fishers' knowledge and expertise can be better included in management, in guiding management to address community needs and values. And as part of that work, we held a workshop that brought together managers from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and fishermen from across the Gulf of Alaska to talk about exactly that. So how can there be more collaboration, more dialogue that's happening between people who are out on the water fishing with an incredible depth of knowledge across generations and the managers who are trying to support local fisheries? Can they be talking to each other outside the sometimes contentious environment where regulations are actually decided on?
Right.
And that workshop was, I think, really successful in creating those dialogues and led to the development of a statewide community engagement plan for rockfish in particular. And some of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Sportfish Division folks here in Juneau said, hey, do you think it's possible to do that for salmon too?
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah, we're going to talk about this study in a little bit. I want to get more into that. And Margaret, how did this idea to have a presentation or discussion come about, and how is the Juneau Library involved?
Sure. We're really mostly a facilitator. So okay. Anne reached out to us last year about a similar program on rockfish.
It was, yes. Right.
And we had a great turnout at that program. And this year she reached out again, and we were more than happy to host her and her researchers once more. So mostly we're doing a lot of the facilitating of this program, and happy to do that with it's great to have such a wide variety of programming available at the library, because we really do try to serve everyone in the Juneau community, including, you know, fishermen and those who work for ADF&G and right. people who are interested in sport fishing, as well as, you know, like readers and children coming to story time and people in who enjoy crafting and that sort of thing. So we try to host programming that appeals to a really wide audience, and getting approached by people like Anne helps us do that.
Absolutely. And so I know this is going to be, again, it's the next Monday, so the 17th at 5 p.m. It's going to be, is it going to be in that big room at
yes.
the library there?
Mm-hmm.
And will you have like special fish books available out
yep.
for people to look at? You set up a little display.
We will. We usually pull a wide variety of books on the topic that we're discussing. So look out for books that are available to check out. You can brush up on your fishing and whatnot.
And maybe there'll be some picture books so you can bring your kids and have them set up
oh, yeah.
while they're in here, while the parents are in there learning about the selective fisheries and
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the library is such a great institution and really does so much for Juneau. So it's really appreciated by everyone that you're able to facilitate these conversations and do that kind of stuff. So, okay. So Anne, let's set the scene a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
For those uninitiated, like myself, what is a selective sports fishery?
Yeah, well, selective fishing really broadly is about targeting fish that are, if we're talking about salmon, maybe from a particular river system or of a particular size. So there have been selective fisheries for salmon for thousands of years, and a lot of really great examples of indigenous fisheries management that have involved, you know, targeting salmon at their rivers when they're returning to those rivers. This is kind of a more niche example of mm-hmm. selective fishing. It's called marked selective fisheries. And this is a form of management that's used largely in the lower 48 and in British Columbia, not widely used in Alaska at this point.
Okay.
And it's where There are some commercial marked selective fisheries, but a lot of them are sport fisheries. And it's where anglers are selectively retaining hatchery-produced fish, and they're releasing the natural origin or the wild fish.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So I think I saw something about this online where there's marked fish. And if you're fishing and you happen to catch one and it isn't one of the marked fish, you are to release it back into the wild because mm-hmm. it's going about its business and doing whatever it's doing.
Right, exactly. Right? And the way that the fish are marked usually is through the removal of the adipose fin, which is the little tiny fin on the back of the salmon right in front of the tail. And so if that adipose fin is gone, then someone fishing can, you know, kind of do a quick visual check and say, yep, this is a marked fish, and then they can retain it.
Is the adipose, is that how you say it? Adipose?
Yes, adipose.
Adipose. Mm-hmm. Is the adipose fin like my wisdom teeth that they don't really need that fin, so it's why that can be removed?
It's funny because I don't know a ton about it, but in some of the reports I was reading, you know, at least at one point it was thought that they didn't really need that fin, you know, kind of like a vestigial organ or right. something like that. But I'm not sure if the salmon would agree with that.
I mean, I think we all want all our parts most of the time, right? It's just interesting because obviously they had to select something, and maybe that's like the least, you know, problematic area of the fish to be able to do that. So, and why do we potentially need a selective fishery for, is this specifically for king salmon?
For sport fishery for targeting king salmon.
For targeting king salmon, yeah. Okay.
Well, we don't necessarily need
that's
one
what we're
yet.
Trying to find out, yeah. I guess, right?
So the reason why they were developed, for example, in Washington,
okay.
One of the big drivers of that was that there were populations that were, you know, had declining survival rates, really reduced numbers. And actually some that have been listed for protection under the Endangered Species Act.
Mm-hmm.
So you have endangered and threatened natural origin populations. Pretty much the only way to give people fishing opportunity in that area was to have this kind of a fishery where they're retaining the hatchery fish and they're hopefully reducing the impact on those natural origin or wild stocks.
I see.
One of the big assumptions or I guess the hope with a marked selective fishery is that you're not causing adverse harm to the fish that you're releasing. And one of the big unknowns is what's the survival rate of those fish when they're released. That's something that, you know, there's some science behind, but it can be, you know, it can be variable depending on where you are. And that's one of the important pieces of data that's needed to effectively manage a fishery like this.
I see. Okay. And is the study that's being done, Margaret, the library is not involved in the study at all,
no.
right? You're just so Anne, this study that's happening and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is involved. Who's doing the study, I guess?
Yeah. So my team at the University of Washington is leading the study, but it was motivated and we were reached out to by Alaska Department of Fish and Game because they had some stakeholders approach them to say, hey, you know, we see this as being done in other places. Could this be a management tool that could be useful here?
I see.
And Alaska Department of Fish and Game really wanted to, you know, before they could say yes or no, they wanted to look at it, you know, and really see what are the lessons learned from other places? What have the costs been? What are the benefits? What's really different about how Southeast Alaska sport king salmon fisheries are managed that may make it, you know, useful in Washington, but maybe not here.
I see.
So we're in the pretty early stages of this project where we really have been focusing on these case studies from outside of Alaska. So looking at examples from Puget Sound, Washington, the Washington coast, Columbia River, British Columbia, and really seeing, you know, how are these fisheries implemented? You know, who's responsible? How are they monitored? What are the different perspectives on whether they're working or not?
Mm.
And that's really a key part of why we're engaging with communities here early in this process, because we want to present what we've learned from elsewhere and see what people think about it.
Right.
We're not the experts, you know. So part of what we're doing is we're bringing together some stories and some lessons learned presenting that. And then on Monday, we're hoping that we have just as much time for conversation, questions from the audience. And also, there's a lot of people with a lot of salmon knowledge who probably have some opinions that they want to share and also some feedback on the project. And that's going to help guide the next phase of what we do.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you're here this week already, and you're sort of having a bunch of meetings that are, mm-hmm. you know, going on behind the doors, and you're meeting with all the Department of Fish and Game and doing all those sorts of things. And then Monday, it's going to be this presentation.
Part of the role of the ADF&G staff is to really help share their expertise with us as we're gathering all of these just hundreds of pages of technical documents and combing through them. So we have our collaborators there, you know, have expertise on the stock assessment side. So the kind of the biology and the math behind fisheries management, and then also on the management side of things and on the enhancement side. So what's the role of hatcheries in all of this? And so they've been sharing a lot of resources with us. And then our team is synthesizing those in a way that we hope is accessible to a broad audience.
That's awesome. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm talking with Anne Beaudreau, Associate Professor at the University of Washington, and also Margaret Ludke from the Public Library. We're talking about a public presentation that is happening on Monday, July 17th. That's next Monday at 5 p.m. at the Mendenhall Public Library about selective sports fisheries for king salmon. So what I'm curious about is, now we were talking just a minute ago, I want to make sure, I'm salmon in Alaska is not endangered, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and so the idea, and I know in some places that's the idea, is to help make sure that the populations are continuing to go forth. Because, and you said, and we're talking about sports fishing, which is different than what?
Different from commercial fishing or subsistence or personal use. And, you know, some of it is here, there's different sorts of regulations involved
right.
for all of those different types of fisheries. The same is true down south. And it's really, really complicated.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's tricky when you introduce a new management tool to the toolbox, you have to know how that's going to increase the complexity of your fishing regulations.
Right.
And that is something that we don't yet know. How, you know, if a tool like this was used here, how would that affect the fishing regulations? That's an unknown. So the next phase of the project will be to take a deeper dive into looking at how are sport fisheries for king salmon and Southeast managed now?
Yeah.
And what would have to change if they were to use an approach like this
okay,
in the
I
future.
See. Yeah. And how long do you think this study is going to take?
Well, it's supposed to take a year, so okay. that's how much time we have. But in the world of salmon, it's just you could easily spend a career and a lifetime and still have more to learn.
Yeah.
So that's where I think what's really important about this project and what really excites me is the fact that we're engaging in these community conversations. So we're doing it now in the early stages. I think people will probably ask us questions we won't have the answers to yet, and
right.
that's okay because that will help direct the next stage of, you know, here are the questions we need to have answers to by the end of this project, or maybe we never will, but they're important concerns that people have in the community.
Well,
and
yeah.
so our results will actually highlight the perspectives that people bring into things like this, the library event on Monday.
Yeah, I think like with any study, it feels like you have to get the right questions, right?
Absolutely.
You don't even really know what, I mean, you're such at the beginning of this mm-hmm. to try to figure out what do we need to look at and what are we looking for? And the question is it needed? Is it wanted? Is it all of that stuff? And what the impact might be? And people will probably jump to the conclusion like, oh, you know, it means I can't do X, Y, Z. But mm-hmm. maybe that's not even what the study is going to conclude. It's really to say, hey, what is like you're saying, what's the impact going to be on the management of the fish? And,
right.
you know.
And what's the benefit going to be potentially to
right.
Someone who is sport fishing? I mean, usually the goals of these types of programs are to increase opportunity. And that can take a lot of different forms. An example from British Columbia is that they call them mixed bag regulations, where you can keep three coho salmon and one of them has to be marked One of them can be unmarked and the other two have to be marked. So two are hatchery fish and the other one is a presumed wild fish.
Do you know how long is the fish in a hatchery before it's released? Do you know?
Well, around here, you know, not a long time, depending on the species. Mm-hmm. Dipak, you know, rears a lot of chum salmon and they're raised to the smolt size mm-hmm. and then they're held in net pens and released in the spring. King salmon and coho salmon spend a little bit longer. I don't know exactly how long. That would be a mm-hmm. great question for one of the hatchery managers.
Yeah, for sure.
They spend a little longer, but they are released as young salmon, juvenile salmon.
Okay.
And then they go and live their life in the salt water before they come back.
So would they I'm just curious, would they still be considered wild salmon?
Oh, this is a sticky question, Boston.
Asking the hard questions here.
Yeah, well, so you might have noticed that I've said sometimes I say natural origin and sometimes I say wild. And those are terms that are used in different places and they mean different things to different people.
Right.
One thing that can happen is hatchery fish can stray. So they come back and they're meant to go to the hatchery, but maybe they stray into a river and perhaps they spawn and their genetics mix with the fish that are there. That, you know, can happen. And so it's a question, it's almost a philosophical question of, are those fish then the young that come back out of that river, are they wild?
Yeah.
So down south, the term natural origin has often been used to kind of capture the fish that are, you know, being born and rearing in a river and out migrating, but you don't necessarily know, you know, their parents, if their parents were also wild fish or
kind of like my children.
Yeah.
They're just wild. Who knows where they're going.
Right.
Whether they come back or not.
And at least for the sake of this conversation, I'm using natural origin and wild to basically mean not hatchery fish, right?
That didn't
come out of the hatchery that year.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
I see. All right. Mm-hmm. So, and I know you're going to highlight some of the lessons learned from the Pacific Northwest selective fisheries mm-hmm. that you have some of the knowledge on. Can you give us a little insight into maybe let's talk about the benefits first of fisheries, mm-hmm. And then we can hit the challenges just in the last few minutes that we have.
Sure.
So what are some of the benefits of a selective sports fishery? And you've mentioned a couple, I think, throughout the interview, but
I think I've already touched on the main benefits that are to increase fishing opportunity where it might not have otherwise existed. So I gave you the example of the mixed bag regulations from BC.
Yeah.
Another example from Washington is that there can be area specific regulations where maybe an area that otherwise would have been closed is open just to a selective fishery, a small area.
I see.
Because, you know, maybe they think that the natural origin populations in that area are more vulnerable.
Mm.
And so it's sort of a tool that's infinitely customizable,
right.
Which also makes it challenging.
I guess it would depend on the area, right? Like what area
you're
serving and what's the population of the fish and the people and all of those things together, right?
Very much. And also that mix, right? The mix mm-hmm. of different stocks. Where are these different populations coming from? And that also can be a mix of different hatcheries. So mm-hmm. that's just a general challenge with salmon management is knowing where those fish are coming from mm-hmm. and then where they end up when they're caught.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what are some of the other challenges of this selective sports fisheries?
I think what we've learned so far from these case studies is that it does increase complexity in a couple of different ways. One is through regulations. So, you know, if there's, you know, anglers have rules that are more specific, you know, you can keep so many marked fish and so many unmarked fish and different sizes. And so that can just make it more complicated for someone who's fishing to kind of wade through, you know, mm-hmm. am I allowed to keep this fish or not? And I think even more so, the complexity comes in on the information needs for the biologist to be able to assess the stocks, meaning like project how many numbers of fish there are that are going to be coming back. And part of that is because of that unknown factor of what happens when you release a fish. What's it? What is its fate? Does it survive or does it die? And how can you factor in that release mortality into estimating the numbers of salmon in each population?
Wow.
Yeah. I have just a spoiler alert. Okay. In the presentation, I show a diagram of all of the different variables and pieces of data that the folks in Washington have to estimate in order to effectively manage these fisheries.
Mm.
So there's also a cost as well to sampling. So more information needs, there's more data that you need about the fish that are harvested.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, this study is, and the examination of this week that you're doing is fascinating. And it seems like we're at the beginning of this study.
Mm-hmm.
And if this conversation has interested you, you can go to this talk on Monday. It's next Monday at the Mendenhall Public Library. It is going to be about selective sports fisheries for king salmon, lessons learned from the Pacific Northwest. Anne will be talking with a few other folks, right? There's some other folks who will be talking as well. They'll be doing a presentation on the things they've learned from the selective sports fisheries down in the Pacific Northwest and along the West Coast. And then also there'll be sort of a Q&A and a discussion about what people are interested in and what and questions they might have about what this would mean. And like we were talking about earlier in the interview, like the direction that maybe the study needs to go and mm-hmm. to get the questions that they need to ask. And it's going to be about a year long, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So come on out and learn a little bit more about selective sports fisheries. Margaret Luedtke from the Public Library, thank you so much for facilitating and hosting the conversation at the library.
Yeah, thanks.
That's awesome. And Anne Beaudreau, thank you for coming back to Juneau. It was a pleasure, I'm sure, when you were here. And I'm sure you're having some fun coming back. Is this your first time back since 2020?
Oh, no. Fortunately, I came back a couple times last summer.
Oh, good.
Yeah, my heart's in Juneau, so I always love coming back.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. But thank you for being here, and thank you for this study. And hopefully you get a good turnout on a Monday and get some great feedback.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being here. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon from KTOO. Here's a savory moment.
Step in to the savory moment. Some days you just need to rely on something completely, to sink into a warm blanket of reassurance. Take a breath and know that whatever you're depending on will definitely come through. Just for today, let it be zucchini. Here's why. First, zucchini are always available in your local produce department, winter, spring, summer, and fall. Second, zucchini are dependable in flavor, mildly sweet and a little grassy, with a soft, creamy texture that soaks up the essence of whatever it's cooked with, like garlic and herbs and cheese. Third, zucchini go wonderfully in a gratin. Something else you can rely on. That classic vegetable dish, baked in a shallow oval with a bubbly, gilded cape of cheese and a soft, savory, spoonable inside. There's a famous zucchini gratin recipe from Julia Child. Talk about reliable. Made with lots of grated zucchini, a puddle of creamy milk, and a golden crust of salty Parmesan. Make a big, homey version of that tonight. Maybe add some chard, fresh dill, a pinch of nutmeg, and a crunchy sprinkle of breadcrumbs. Serve with a salad of grated beets tossed with fresh orange juice, and you've got dinner. But the final reason you can always rely on zucchini is maybe the most important. It goes so well with chocolate, as evidenced by the miracle of chocolate zucchini bread. Maybe fold in some chocolate chips? Now that's trustworthy. So there you have it, not just one thing to rely on, but four: zucchini, gratins, Julia Child, and chocolate. Five things if you count the chocolate chips. Today is your day. Find the full recipe for homey zucchini gratin at savorymoment.org. From the studios of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska, I'm Beth Short Rhodes. Whatever is on your dinner table tonight, may you savor the moment.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Clene Di have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot, once part of the Tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these Tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life, for today and for future generations. We'd like to take a moment and say thank you to the individuals who helped us craft our daily land acknowledgement. Gwyneth Cheesh to Vera Starbart, who planted the idea of making it super place specific and guided us on pronunciation. Lillian Petershore, who created so much of the beautiful structure. Ishmael Hope, who gave us additional ideas, and Ernestine Hayes, Bob Sam, and Fran Houston, who gave important feedback. We are grateful to all those offering guidance as we grow as an organization.
This is Bird Note. Writer and environmentalist Bill McKibben has been pushing for climate solutions for decades. Now in his 60s, he's reflecting on how his generation approaches a warming climate differently than younger folks.
I mean, if you're 25, well, this is like self-defense. If we don't get the climate crisis under control, your whole life's going to be warped by it. Look, I'm going to be dead before the worst of this stuff kicks in. So for people my age, it's less about self-defense and more about kind of defense of, more about your legacy, about what you leave behind, which sounds like an abstract concept, but really your legacy is the world you leave behind for the people you love the most.
Bill's working to organize people age 60 and older with his new group called Third Act to leave behind a better world.
And we do not want to be the first generation to leave behind a world that's worse than the one we found. But that's what we're doing. I mean, if there's 3 billion fewer birds on it than when we were born, that's not good, you know? That's a failure. And that's why we're doing what we can to try and correct it.
Hear more of Bill McKibben's thoughts on the realities we're facing with climate change on the Bring Birds Back podcast. Listen in your favorite podcast app or at birdnote.com. I'm Tanaja Hamilton.
Don't you cry.
Summertime from Janice. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Akwan. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. The mission of the Southeast Alaska Master Gardeners Association is to develop Southeast Alaska's community of gardeners through education, hands-on learning, community service, and practicing the art and science of gardening. And this Saturday is the Garden Tour, 9 inspiring gardens in the downtown and Twin Lakes area. It's going to be happening Saturday, July 15th, that's this Saturday, from 11 to 4 p.m. The tour is a fundraiser for the association. And here to share about the Master Gardeners and this lovely tour are Pat Harris, board member. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Eric Boston.
Hi, and Christy Hooten, president of the association.
Hello.
Hi, nice to see you.
Nice
welcome.
To see you.
Good to cheese for you both being here today. Okay, so first of all, I think a lot of people here, I mean, Margaret was just in here from the Juno Library, and you all work with the library a lot on different things that come up. But people hear Master Gardeners Association, and they go, what is that? So, Christy, will you tell us what the Master Gardeners Association is and does?
The mission describes it really well. We're really about helping people find and get the tools, learn the tools that they need to have a successful gardening experience.
I see. So you don't have to be a master gardener to be part of the association.
Well, you should have taken the course.
Yes.
There's a course.
Yes. There's a Master Gardener course that's offered by the UAF Extension Service. And it's a 40-hour classroom or combination, sometimes Zoom and classroom course.
Well, see, that's good to know. I didn't know there was a course involved.
Because there's
a lot of, I guess we would call them amateur gardeners out there in the world. I would call myself that, you know, trying to plant some little things here and there every year and see what happens. We're experimenting with a Tlingit potato right now, which is kind of fun. What does the course do? Let me make sure I know this. The Master Gardeners is also a national service organization as well. So this is the Southeast Alaska Master Gardener. So it's like a chapter of the national organization.
Yeah. Correct. Okay. Correct. This association is separate from the Cooperative Extension Service, but it's under the umbrella of the Cooperative Extension Service.
I see.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks.
I see.
At least in Alaska, but it is a national program.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what do you learn in this 40-hour course?
Well, just about everything, about soils, about plant physiology, nutrients in soil, which the plants need, different types of plants need different nutrients. You learn about greenhouses, lawns, houseplants.
Mm.
So you get a pretty well-rounded taste of what gardening is. And maybe they don't go into detail in anything too specifically, but it kind of gives you a broad idea of what you could get involved in.
Right. So what do you both do in terms of your, are you growing like vegetables and things like that? Or are you growing flowers? What do you guys like to do?
I do a little bit of both. I have quite a few perennial beds I have a large yard, so I have quite a few perennial beds. I have raised beds for the vegetables that I want to grow that year. Like this year I planted some beets.
Oh, nice.
But I've kind of gotten crazy with the perennials. The plants that come back every year.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like less work, maybe. I don't know. But then there's weeding
yeah.
to do, right?
Oh, for yeah. Sure. Lots and lots of weeding.
We love the weeds.
How much bare soil you have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What about you, Pat? What do you do? What do you dabble in?
I live in a deep, dark forest. So I don't do much in my yard. I have a little flower bed about this big. I'm gesturing with my hands about 4x6.
Right, right.
Which I have. I think it's 9 varieties of primroses in, so I'm really in love with this little flower bed, but it's very small. Easy to take care of because it's so small and easy to weed, and I don't need to water it much. But that's my extent of flower gardens, but I do vegetables at the community garden, and that's my big deal there. I've been part of the community garden for about 25 years now. So.
Oh, wow. What's the best? What are some of the best vegetables that you like to grow?
Well, the dependable ones, of course, are spuds.
Okay, yes.
And I'm delighted to hear you're experimenting with the Tlingit potatoes because they are fun. And we've had some really good results with them.
Yeah.
At the Arboretum as well.
Lettuce grows well.
Yeah.
I have some lettuce growing right now. I also put some potatoes and potato starts in buckets this year. But lettuce does really well, too.
I know. Isn't it like, is butter lettuce something that's been that people
yeah,
grow
sure.
up here?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's the best kind. Doesn't seem to get as bitter as some of the other varieties.
Right.
I've been growing asparagus for about 5 or 6 years, that's been fun. And I wouldn't say terribly productive, but I picked about 80 spears so far this year. So
That's a lot, right? And that seems like a lot.
You know, I get maybe 4 or 5 per picking. And so that's basically a snack in the garden, not enough to take home and invite your friends over for dinner.
Right. What are the things that, what's the thing I should not try to grow in Juno? What have you experimented with and just gone, nope?
I think lots of things are worth experimenting with. I mean, some years you can pull it off, some years you can't, like corn. Mm. We've had some people get successful crops of corn here. And,
wow.
They're short.
Yeah.
Yeah, the short.
Yeah. Not
and smaller varieties. But there are, you know, there are varieties that you can do and or try every year. And people start pretty early with that, seedlings in the house, and then they transplant them out. So lots of work.
Right.
Patience.
Yeah. A lot of people will, at the community garden, I see a lot of first-year gardeners putting tomatoes and peppers out like in May. And that's just, and they have varieties of tomatoes that take a long time, which is not a good idea either. If you're going to do tomatoes, get short maturity dates. Mm. And you can do under plastic at the community garden.
I mean, we get tons of rain, right? So it seems like it's a great place to grow things. But then it feels like, for some reason, that maybe there's challenges in some of the things that you grow here because of the weather that we have.
Yes, the wet soil is cold soil, so it helps to have a system in place so you can cover your beds periodically to let the soil dry out a little bit, warm up.
I see. Yeah. And then for those who maybe don't have access to a home garden or a community garden, because those are slots that you get, right? That you get to pick a slot in the community garden. And if you don't have access to that, but you want to try your hand at it, and you're saying you have a little like 4x6 area in your dark forest, which I love the idea of that. but can people experiment with like trays and things in their homes or on their porches, right? You can do a little bit of that, right? Their decks?
Container gardening.
Container gardening.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you can grow a lot in a container.
Yeah.
Different sizes. The larger, the better for, say, the cruciferous, you know, things that need deep roots.
Yeah.
But for instance, as I mentioned earlier, the lettuce, they shallow roots. You can grow those in like a gutter.
Yeah. People have...
Gutter gardening is a thing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've also heard that there's that great organization in town, Juno Composts, and I know that she's been making soil out of some of this compost. And apparently that stuff is feature rich in terms of, you know, probably for maybe some kind of container gardening. That would be a way to go if you don't have like the yard or the dirt around you to be able to do it. That might be a way to get started.
Sure. Compost is always a good idea for anything, I believe. I also have a worm bin, and so I make worm tea.
Oh.
And that's really helpful too for most plants.
Wow.
And the castings, you use the worm?
Yeah, you take the castings out of the worm tower and put in water with a bubbler and let it brew for a little while.
Wow. That would be a tough one for me to sip on, a worm tea. I don't know if I could get into that or not. I'm not sure, but I'd probably try it.
No, I said that was just for plants.
I haven't really
tasted it or anything.
Okay.
It doesn't smell bad. I mean, it's phenomenal. It's wonderful stuff. And, it's not like using other manure from other animals.
Right. Right. And so beyond, I know we're going to talk about this garden tour that's happening Saturday, I'm talking with the Master Gardeners Association about the upcoming garden tour, and we're learning a little bit about gardening. But what other events or what other things does the Master Gardeners do throughout the year?
Well, we try to offer a workshop or a lecture each month between like September and April.
Okay.
This year we did a lecture series with the focus on landscaping.
Mm, okay.
We did that. What was that? February, March, and April. We had two lectures back to back.
That was
we collaborated with the library.
Yeah,
so
great.
We were just talking about library collaboration. I mean, they were looking for partners, and we like to be their partner too.
Yeah, it was absolutely nice. They helped with they helped us with some of the advertising, and we used their large conference room in front. And those are all open to the public. There's no charge.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And that's the thing is that the Master Gardeners is an all volunteer organization, right?
This is something the association is for the volunteers.
Yeah. People are doing this for the love of, as it were. and that is something, you know, I mean, that really is.
I have to hand it to Christy, our president. She's probably most of the weight of the organization right now. So hats off to her.
Yay, Christy.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, part of the reason I volunteered to be elected as president is I currently do have the time. Yeah. And I think of being a master gardener as something to strive to be. When I took the class years and years ago, I actually ended up taking it twice because there can be a lot to absorb and process.
Mm.
And each class is different, you know.
Right.
And but I was a little intimidated by the title, Master Gardener.
Yeah.
I did my 40 hours. I did more than 40 hours. But I think of it as something to strive to be.
Right. I see. Okay. Well, that's great. And your community service, your service to the organization, I'm sure, is, as Pat's saying, is really welcomed. And it seems like we have just a great, strong community of gardeners here in Juneau.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yay.
Great bunch of folks. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So I would like to just make a comment about that.
Yeah, sure.
If I may.
Yeah.
So I was in here talking to you about the plant sale we had in May.
Oh, yeah.
The super plant sale. So that's our spring kickoff for gardeners. This is the summer event for gardeners, the garden tour.
Yeah.
And in the fall, there's a couple of harvest type fairs. There's one at the community garden. And then there's something, food festival or something at the Jack usually, which is which people sell produce and stuff. And so three big events for gardeners. And so this is the middle of the season.
This is the middle of it. Right. And and like you said, this is an annual tradition. The garden tour comes up every year. And do you choose different gardens every year?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
We do try to find
a new
lineup of gardens each year. And over the years, we have revisited other gardens.
Oh, sure.
We do like to do that because they mature and change.
Yeah.
But on one particular, from one year to the next, there should be different gardens on the tours. And we try to change the area up also.
I see. Okay. And I know this is a fundraiser for the organization. I think the tickets are $20. Mm-hmm. And I know you can go to, I just want to give out the website now and I'll give it at the end as well. SEAK-mastergardeners.org. And you can find there's a button on there and it says, you know, here's the tour. And the cool thing is that the secret locations will be revealed Friday after 5 p.m. So,
you know,
why don't you sign up now and be surprised at where you're going to go? There are some descriptions on the website there of sort of a tease of where some of these locations might be and a little bit of history about kind of what the property is or whose garden, not whose garden it is, but just kind of what might be in that garden. So you can get a little preview of it. So how are the gardens chosen for the tour?
We try to decide kind of, you know, on an area that we want to focus on. And then we, for instance, I do a lot of driving around and we ask folks, other gardeners for nominations of gardens that they really enjoy. And then we contact those owners. And I sometimes just stop and knock on someone's door and say, hey, I love your garden. You know, I'm with the Master Gardeners Association. And that's, Pat and I have driven around and I've driven around with Deb before and I go by myself and I walk around and I just talk to people. And
okay. Yeah. So what kind of variety of gardens are we looking at this weekend? Can you give us a little tease? What
kind of variety?
Or what kind of things will we see in some of these gardens?
Well, I think lots of flowers.
Peonies,
and some vegetables.
Yeah,
peonies for sure. There's a lovely, lovely laurel tree on one of the properties.
Oh, nice.
I think there's climbing hydrangeas. There's a bunch of climbing hydrangeas.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, they're really nice displays. Different sizes. There's different sizes of gardens this year. Sometimes, you know, the majority of them are on the large size. This year we have, you know, some large gardens. We have some, you know, more compact gardens. You know, lots to see kind of in a smaller area so you can get an idea, you know, what you can do with smaller spaces.
Yeah, I think that's great because I feel like part of the idea of going on the tour is not to appreciate the nine gardens that we're going to be going on?
Well, we actually have eight. We did have nine.
Okay.
Unfortunately, one of our owners had to bow out at the last minute, unfortunately.
Yeah, okay.
But eight is a great number.
Eight's a great number. Eight is enough, as they say. But eight is but you're going to get to see these gardens and appreciate them. But also, I think what's really cool about it is that you might get inspired, right? Because you're seeing what other people are doing, and you'll be able to talk to the owners of the garden, and you'll also be on the tour with other people. And so, like, the sharing of knowledge between, like, oh, I tried to grow that. and I couldn't do that, but look at this beautiful thing and how does the sunlight hit it? Because I know that's another problem. Like you said, Pat, you're in the deep forest and, you know, maybe don't get a lot of sunlight. And so what can you grow in that as opposed to if you live, you know, on the hill and you get a lot of sunlight or you're getting that afternoon light or whatever it is, seems like it's a great way to be inspired, right?
It is.
Exactly.
It's an excellent way to find inspiration.
I think even for people that don't garden, it's inspiring just to see what people can do.
Yeah, just to appreciate. Plants. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And are you free to like take pictures and all that kind of stuff?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Okay.
Yeah, because I know you can hit the website and you can find out like all the it says rules. There's rules. What are the rules?
Rules or housekeeping? One of them that we'd like to stress is that there aren't bathrooms available at any of the gardens. So kind of plan accordingly, you know, find a spot. And I will be adding little tips into the garden brochure that'll be available to print.
Okay.
And there's information, that information will also be updated by Friday. Okay. Right now, you know, there's basic rules, you know, please don't ask the host to use their bathrooms, you know, right. No animals, no smoking, you know, don't leave trash around. You know,
don't walk in the flower beds.
It's not nice to pick any of the plants, you know, take samples without permission. You know, that's a no-no.
Have all these rules been created because somebody has made that infraction in the past?
Not that I know of. I've been helping with the tour a long time. I haven't heard any complaints like
okay,
that.
Good.
Yeah, I think it's just precautionary.
Common knowledge, I think. Yeah.
Gotcha. But, yeah, it's common sense, good rules, good ways, good, like you said, housekeeping in terms of keeping the tour going. And how many people would be on the tour? Does it have a limit or no?
Well, we haven't been challenged yet to set a limit. I think as of a few hours ago, there was about 216 tickets sold.
And how does it work? Do you have is there hosts that are guiding you around or do you get a list and you go to the places and there might be somebody there to tell you a little bit about it?
Well, each of the gardens will have an owner and they will also have a couple of docents, we call them. So volunteers to help the owners, manage their guests.
Right, right.
But, you know, help show people around, help answer questions. What was the other part? Sorry, what was the other part of that question?
Just will people be going to, do you go on your own? Do you have a map and you drive to the location yourself?
We don't provide maps anymore, but we will, as of Friday evening, provide you the homeowner's name and the addresses.
Right, okay.
And, you know, for instance, a couple of the gardens have stairs, so there'll be a note, you know, watch for stairs you know, uneven elevations. And we always recommend people, you know, wear sturdy shoes and, you know, be prepared for the weather.
So it's basically because it's from 11 to 4. So it's basically like an open house for those 5 hours. Yes. You get the locations and the information and you can take your time.
Yes.
You can go off and have lunch somewhere. You're not trapped into that full 5 hours. You can take a couple hours to go and visit. Yeah.
You stay 5 minutes at one garden, stay half an hour or whatever, as long as you want at the other gardens. You go in any order you wish.
Gotcha.
They'll probably not be listed in any particular order. I haven't figured that out yet. But
right.
Yeah. So and self-guided tour, I think, is the way.
Self-guided. Yes. There we go. And you're going to Juneau, and I think you said you might have – where are the locations? Do we have Auk Bay? Do we have Douglas? Do we have Juneau?
We're concentrated downtown this year.
Mostly downtown. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, that's the Master Gardeners Association Garden Tour. It's coming up this Saturday, July 15th. It's from 11 to 4 p.m. Pat and Christy have been here from the association to give us all the details about it. It sounds really fun. Sounds beautiful. Sounds like a lot of good pictures. And hopefully weather will be good. And what was that, Christy?
I was just going to mention that if you want to use your credit card to make a purchase, you go to our website, which is SEAK-MasterGardeners.org. And you should easily find the links to do that. And if you want to make a cash or check purchase, those will be available at one of the gardens starting at 11 a.m. on Saturday morning.
And that's
will
nice.
Also
okay.
be that information, which garden will have the ticket sales in cash or check. That'll be listed by Friday also.
Okay. So you can just start the tour and then pay up at some location on the tour. Kind of thing.
If you want to buy a ticket with cash or check, you're going to want to go to that specific location
first
to make your purchase.
Oh, because you have to get a wristband.
Yes, exactly. You'll get a wristband for your
Right, because you can't just be any lollygagger going on the tour without paying up, right? You want to.
Right, we're really strict about that.
This is a fundraiser for Pete's sake.
Show your purchase for your wristband, yes.
Well, Gwyneth Teach-Rebolt being here today, go to seak-mastergardeners.org for more information about this awesome garden tour. I'm sure we'll have you guys back in the fall for the fall event, and please reach out anytime. We love Master Gardeners here on Juno Afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Have a wonderful Wednesday. On tomorrow's show, a preview of Theater Alaska's 12th Night, the Jack's upcoming voice workshop, and this weekend's Heart of the Wetlands walk. Juno Afternoon airs Tuesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Thanks, and have a glorious Juno evening.